Session number 13265, reel number 34.
Mr. Marsden, reel 34.
Yes, there was work was organized. You knew your work was organized. You did your work. Payday came along every fortnight. Pay parade, and you drew your pay. And by the end of the war, my pay was going pretty well. I was Corporal Fitter to E, and I was drawing of the order of 14 and sixpence a day. My pay as a Corporal Fitter to E was something over 8 shillings a day. And then there was the so-called long service pay, for which we wore those little red chevrons on the sleeve. Have you come across those?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. And I can't remember whether you began to draw pay for those when they were introduced for all your service after the first 3 years. I think it was something of that order. And we drew so much a year. And I think at one time I was wearing 5 of those red chevrons or something of that order. I'm not too certain. Anyway, my pay, as I say, was about 14 and 6 a day, and it was slightly more than a Sprog pilot officer's. And since throughout the war, I'd made an allotment, first of all to my aunt, of 1 and 6 months a day, 10 and 6 months a week, which in those days was a reasonable amount. When I got married, I discovered that my aunt had been banking this allotment to her, and she transferred the bank book over to Margaret and myself. Margaret continued to bank it, and I made my allotment up to 50% of salary, or to whatever was the maximum which we were allowed to make, of the order of 50%. So that throughout the war, Margaret had been saving this money, and I'd been drawing the smallest amount I was allowed to draw, since I didn't drink worth a damn, and I didn't smoke. All I needed it for was for train fares and my chocolate ration and so on, and soap and cleaning materials. I this again was one of the things that produces a slight culture shock when you move out of the service into Civvy Street. In the service, you can actually get by on very little money in the pocket at all. In Civvy Street, you pay for everything.
So, was there any sense of panic or worry because you were no longer regimented?
Well, neither panic nor worry, because panic and worry are not things that I've ever greatly done. But there was a curious feeling of loss. Yes. There is a feeling of insecurity at first as well. You it's rather like the prisoner coming out of prison who doesn't know whether to stand still and yell or run in all directions because he's free, I guess. There is a curious feeling, possibly in wartime the more strong than for people in peacetime. I don't know. Because, of course, war service does tend to be a bit more intense. You're much more, I think, perhaps much more deeply involved. It was odd. Anyway, this is getting away from wartime, but it's still related to it. I went home to Chesterfield and immediately went in to see the Director of Education. And said, look, I've applied for teacher training. I shall be going on a teacher training course, and I shall certainly apply for to serve in Chesterfield. Can you set me up as a temporary teacher? And the director of education, Greenough, knew of me, because of course I'd passed the word, and friends of mine were teachers, and one of them in particular was the science master at William Road School in Chesterfield, Percy Pearson, had taught with Greenough when Greenough had been the headmaster at William Rhodes, and the word gets around, and so Greenough more or less expected me going in anyway, and I got a temporary teaching job. And so after 2 weeks leave I went to William Rhodes School as a temporary teacher, and got stuck into teaching geography and history as on a part-time assistant basis. Well, I was there full-time, but I wasn't properly timetabled for either of these subjects. And this, of course, gives you something concrete to go at and so on, and so the sense of disorientation and so on rapidly died off. One of the items I missed goes back to 1940, when, as a flight mechanic, I've mentioned earlier that we would do a test run on our engines every day and check the mag drop. And we were allowed a magneto drop of 50 RPM on maximum revs. To understand what I'm talking about, you have to understand that aero engines, ever since the First World War, for the RAF, have had to have twin ignition systems, two magnetos. And that involves, in the case of inline engines, what came to be known as, what we'd refer to as inlet plugs and exhaust plugs. Because one spark plug in each cylinder would be on the inlet valve side of the cylinder, and one spark plug in each cylinder would be on the exhaust valve side of the cylinder. Because if you imagine a Merlin engine as a V engine, two cylinder blocks, each cylinder block nearly a yard long with six cylinders in it, sitting adjacent to each other on the crankcase at an angle of 60 degrees, included angle, and running between them an induction trunk carrying the petrol air mixture, which has been fed through the supercharger and compressed to be pushed into the engine. That means that on the inside of these blocks, on the inside of the V, you have the inlet valves on the cylinders, and in the head adjacent to them you have in each cylinder a spark plug, the inlet plugs. Now, by definition on an engine, inlet plugs will run cooler than exhaust plugs. You see that, don't you? Because they're on the cold side of the... I'm speaking in relative terms here. They're on the cold side of the cylinder because the cool incoming mixture of petrol and air comes in through that side of the engine, of the cylinder, and then when the cylinder fires, the hot combustible product, hot burn product, goes out through the exhaust side, so that side is definitely hotter, which means that the cold plugs tend to have different problems from the hot plugs. And in fact, when an engine is running slowly, the cooler inlet plugs tend to oil up, because the lubricating oil, which is travelling around in the engine, isn't burned off so fully from the cooler inlet plugs as it is from the exhaust plugs, which literally are running pretty nearly red hot. So when you do a magneto check, you have an ignition switch for each of the magneto systems. Each magneto, it drives its own set of 12 plugs. One magneto drives all exhaust plugs, one magneto drives all inlet plugs, etc. You switch off one magneto when the engine's doing full revs, and naturally there's a small drop in RPM in the engine because the ignition is no longer as perfect or as good as it was before. And if the magneto drop at that time was greater than 50 RPM, then the engine was considered to be unserviceable, and we had to get it to the point where the magneto drop was less, which meant that we had to find the plugs which were not firing properly. Because when one set of plugs is switched out, then the other plugs, the other 12 plugs, are all that are running the engine. And if one or two plugs there are misfiring, then you get a drop in revs. So you have to find which plugs are not firing properly, which is not easy. We didn't have any electronic apparatus. We didn't have those little neon testers or anything of that order. And the whole system is screened with braided cable, and the plugs themselves are designed with metal screening, tubular steel outside, so there's no portion of the actual plug carrying the spark is exposed to the air. This is to reduce interference with the radio in the aircraft. It's difficult. There were no easy ways of, with electrical instruments, of finding which plugs are not working. The only way to do it is to do it by checking the actual temperature of the plugs themselves. So what we had to do was to allow the engine to cool, and then we'd have the cowlings off, and one of us then would climb onto the aircraft, get onto the engine, and lie on the engine with our head about a foot away from the propeller, right up, full length, on top of the engine, and the other bod then, we get a third person to come along and operate the starter trolley, and chap in the cockpit would start the engine up and proceed to run the engine up to run the engine up to heat again, up to working temperature. Now, then, say, as in my case, I'm lying on the engine, I'm the engine mech, I feel the engine coming up to temperature, and when it gets hot enough, I flag with my hand behind me to switch the engine off, switch it out, and then I scramble back as best I can on top of the engine. It's you're encouraged to scramble because it's hot enough. And I feel at each plug as I come back, and I find which plugs are cooler than the others. And those plugs, I memorise those plugs, and when I get down, we get the plug spanner, and we take those plugs out, put new replacement plugs in, and we try again. And we do this until we've got the mag drop into the proper bracket. It probably, to an outsider, it probably looks quite dangerous, but it's perfectly safe. After all, nobody in his right mind is going to climb forwards into the propeller, even though it's very close to you and it's hurtling around. It's very noisy, it's very hot, it's quite easy to burn yourself because the exhaust stubs there, if, as you're feeling around, they're hot enough to burn you very nicely. I had one or two burns from those. And as I say, it's very the big thing is the noise and the vibration, but perfectly safe, but a very handy technique. And did that many a time. That was that's one item missed. The other item was that business of that flight in the Wildebeest in New Zealand, Vickers Wildebeest. We had at Rooker here, we had two or three Wildebeest. Vickers Wildes, which it's an aircraft very similar to the fairy swordfish, designed for the same purpose, for coastal reconnaissance, coastal command work, anti-submarine work and so on. The Vildi carries an enormous payload. And there were two or three of these aircraft at Rooka here which were used as convenient transports for odd jobs, as well as for giving the various pilots who were there the chance to keep their hand in. It's a very large open cockpit biplane, fabric covered, steel tube framework, and as all those aircraft dating to the early 30s designed for this kind of work, quite large rear cockpit. The rear cockpit is amply big enough for two people to stand in it. Because I'm keen on aeroplanes and I like flying, I'd spent some time trying to fix up to get a flight in one of these wildebeests, and an occasion cropped up when we had to, or when some engine spares or something similar had to be flown over to Gisborne from Hamilton, from Rooka here. And the wildebeest was convenient, and so I managed to go along as passenger on this flight over the range of hills between Hamilton and Gisborne, a range of hills called the Mamakoos. And when I got into the Vildi before we took off, I queried the fact that there was no safety strap in the rear cockpit for the passenger. There's usually a monkey strap, usually an eye bolt fixed in the floor or on the fuselage framework, and a steel cable and a strap to put round the waist of the standing passenger, and there's no strap either for a folding seat, so that you've got a lap strap or anything. There's no safety strap of any kind, and I was aware that from aircraft like this in the past, rear passengers had been lost, which was why I queried the point. But that was brushed aside. The pilot said, "Oh no, we never bother about things like that." And so off we went, flew over to Gisborne, delivered our hardware, and I think we stayed over there and had a midday meal there and got back to the kite, started her up and came back. And on the way back, coming through the Mamakoos, the pilot dropped down low towards the hills and began contour chasing. I suppose we were probably flying at 100 or 200 feet or so above the surface. And he was thoroughly enjoying himself. The Vildi is it's fully aerobatic. And had a Pegasus engine turning a very big two-bladed wooden prop, so that in ordinary flight you can almost hear the prop blades going past, woof, woof, woof. It's quite a slow revving engine, and we were trundling along very nicely and uphill and down dale, as it were, flying quite close to the nap, and I'm just enjoying myself. Standing in the cockpit, looking forward and looking around, watching in all directions. And we began to go down a longish valley with a stream in the bottom. I'm just idly watching things. And quite suddenly, the aeroplane vanished from beneath me. It'd be wrong to say I was thrown out, because what happened was that I was obeying the laws of motion and carrying on the line of flight that the aeroplane had set up for me, and the aeroplane had literally dropped from beneath me. He'd bunted the aircraft, he'd followed the water course over the... it became a waterfall, and he'd followed it down. Gone down and angled over in a sharpish dive. Well, I didn't get very far from the aeroplane, because as the aeroplane dropped from beneath me, my toes, I think, caught the cockpit combing at the front edge. Either that, or even more luckily, they caught the trailing edge of the wing centre section, because the next thing I knew was that I found myself flat on my face, scrabbling like mad on the upper centre section of the wing, the centre section of the top wing, and immediately in front of me are the big propeller blades wafting past, and the ground. I'm looking down at the ground, and I'm sliding forward slowly, and I'm scrabbling like crazy, trying to convert my hands into suckers to get as much friction and grip on the surface of the wing as I can. And I discovered I could spread my legs and get my toes down behind the trailing edge of the wing and hang on. And really, I was... if I was terrified, it was probably only with a fraction of my percentage of the mind, because I was really far too busy trying to achieve a grip and stopping the forward slide. And meanwhile, I'm still seeing the ground ahead of me and the stream running away, and I'm mentally cursing the pilot for being such a stupid so-and-so. And then quite suddenly the aircraft levelled out at the bottom, and I haven't slid forward any further. The propeller, which had seemed very close, in fact, probably hadn't been anywhere nearer than possibly a foot and a half behind the leading edge of the wing, so that the propeller, in fact, was probably 5 or 6 feet from me. Not nearly as close as it felt. And no real speed, because the top speed of a wildebeest, I suppose, might be 110 or 120, and in normal cruising flight, you'd be doing 90 or 100 thereabouts. They're not fast aeroplanes like the Swordfish. So we pulled out into level flight, and I'm still clasping myself as tightly as I can to the bosom of the centre section. Now I begin to get frightened, because I now have to wonder how the devil I'm going to get down, and I have to sort of ginger up the confidence in order to slide backwards into empty space in the hope that I'm going to drop clean into the cockpit. Well, I had the option. I thought, well, I can either hang on here and get cold and slip, or try to hang on until we get back to Rooker here, which will be 3/4 of an hour or so, or I take the bull by the horns and slide off backwards and hope that I go into the cockpit and not catch my feet on the fuselage and get tipped off. Well, there are no handholds, you see, on the centre section of that wing. There are no filler caps. There are no access panels to anything. It's just plain doped fabric. So that when I started sliding backwards, I had to just hope for the best. Well, eventually I grasped all the courage I'd got and slid myself off backwards, and with a thump and a scrape, ended up in the back cockpit, flat on my back, and feeling very relieved. And picked myself up and decided that I was a pretty lucky guy and did my best to enjoy the flight for the rest of the way back. When we landed, the pilot was a Flight Louis, and I chewed him off uphill and down Dale, and I called him a stupid so-and-so. He'd simply forgotten that I was in the back, and had forgotten what would happen when he bunted the aircraft. It had the same effect as catapulting me out of the cockpit. In the First War, quite a few chaps were lost in that way, and quite a few were lost in Fairy Gordon's, which had similar-sized rear cockpits in Egypt in the 20s. and that was when the monkey strap was devised and brought into use. Oh, that was, I think that was nearly one of the most, I suppose that was one of the dodgiest bits of the war as far as I was concerned, apart from the odd near misses. The other incident of a near miss type, I was in London and I think I was heading for St Pancras Station. I forget exactly where I'd been, but a V2, as I guessed afterwards, there was a sudden enormous explosion quite close to where I was in the street. There'd been no air raid warning or anything else, there was just this ginormous bang, followed by the sound as of a rushing mighty wind. And I realised immediately that a V2 had arrived, and I'd been lucky in being just far enough away to have missed all the damage and blast. People said that they were frightened of V2s, but I found it difficult to be frightened of them, because if you heard them, you were alive, and if you didn't hear them, you didn't have time to be frightened. You know, there was really no point in being afraid of them. They were a very curious weapon.
Was that when you were at St Athan or Henlow?
Oh, I'd be at Henlow then, I think.
So it would have been 45?
44. It was before the end of the German War, obviously.
Because it started...
Oh, no, that might have been... That was probably when I still was Second Taff. When I was... I'd have been coming up from Tangmere, from Slindon.
I doubt it, because you said that you joined RAF St Athan in June 44, and the V2s didn't start till September 44.
That it may have been later when I went to St Athan.
Well,
bearing in mind, June was the invasion, and we were down for Nijmegen and so on, and it probably would have been later than June 44 when I went to St Athan. That sounds quite likely.
Probably late 1944.
Yeah, later in 44. In fact, the more I think about it, I think I was trying to rationalise that date for June, but I think it must have been September, October time when I went across to St Athan. Must have been, I think. Yeah. That's about it.
Can you talk about Frank Muir and Dennis Norden?
Ah, they were at Henlow. They were LACs, leading aircraftmen. Where they were and what duties they had, I don't know, but they got themselves involved in running station shows. I attended one of them. They were very well organised and pretty well produced, well done. and I was reminded of the so-called meal that we had at Billy Rose's Diamond Horseshoe. Was it Billy Rose? The Diamond Horseshoe in New York. Norden Muir had this idea that instead of having everybody packed in on Rose's seats, they would have it in nightclub fashion, and so there were tables everywhere, and as I recall, we all got a tiny serving of Heinz beans on something or other as part of the setup.